One of the big trends, I think, that's really come about in the last 4 or 5 years is the level of corporate venture capital activity. Again, I've been doing this long enough to remember that there were a significant number of corporations in the late 90s and the early 2000s who felt like they had to get in the venture capital game because of the exploding valuations, the emergence of the internet, and the implementation of business models around the internet. And that trend has returned. I think it's, again, driven by the fact that technology seems to be touching virtually every facet of our world and is transforming virtually every industry, literally, like I pointed out before, from water faucets to taxi services to just about anything you can imagine. Corporate venture capital funds that you see these days, the most active are Intel Capital, who's always been a big player, Google Ventures, now known as GV Capital, and Salesforce Ventures. Microsoft's M12 is also very active. It looks like there are more than 1,000 companies worldwide who have now established a CVC fund. The interesting thing is, and by the way, I'm getting a lot of this data from PitchBook, a lot of these CVC groups are, let's see, the median age is 4 years, and the average age is 6 years. So a lot of these companies are probably very inexperienced in terms of investing in this space. And so you're going to see a lot of mistakes. You're going to see a lot of, I think, pumping up evaluations, which is a common criticism of CVCs. So why do CVCs do this? I mean, there's generally three reasons. I think historically, these guys have been looking to invest in companies because they are looking for strategic investments. They're looking for market intelligence. To some degree, they're looking for a pipeline for future acquisitions. They're really kind of trying to stay out in front of current trends and make sure that they're not being disrupted by startups out there. And they want to have the opportunity to invest in those kinds of disruptive companies and then potentially buy them at some point. To a lesser degree, they're also looking for a rate of return. I think the statistics show that the CVC groups have established the rate of return of the group as at least one metric in how they measure success. One thing I want to get into regarding corporate venture capital and its impact is the fact that it often comes with strings attached. So a lot of times these deals come with a couple things. There's a strategic partnership agreement or some sort of reseller agreement that gets negotiated in connection with the investment. That thing often has strings attached, and including things like they try to negotiate exclusive licenses, various other exclusive things, maybe exclusive markets, maybe most favored nation clauses on pricing, et cetera. I'm not going to get into that stuff in too much detail because I'm sure that's something that the licensing folks will cover. But I do want to talk about a couple others, in particular, what's known as a right of first refusal. So a lot of these guys will, as a condition to their investment, try to push these companies to enter into what's called a right of first refusal to buy the company. I just happen to be neck deep in negotiating, navigating one of these things for about the last 12 days. I spent 3 hours this morning working on this thing. But I guess rule number one I would say is don't do it. Please don't let your clients enter into rights of first refusal by the company. So the common criticism, there's three, and I'm going to give you examples of how this plays out. So the first is these things deter other bidders, right? So if a company has a right of first refusal to buy your client, essentially what they're saying is if you get an offer to buy your client, if your client gets an offer to be acquired, this other company, the strategic partner, has the right to match that offer and buy the company. Most companies, to the extent they know that you have a ROFR, will not even make an offer. There's a very well-known, very acquisitive company out of Silicon Valley that I happen to have sold a client to, and early stages of diligence, before they would even deliver an LOI, they specifically asked the question, do you have any rights of notice? Do you have any rights of first offer, et cetera? And basically, they made clear that if you do, then we're not going to give you an LOI. Your instruction is going to be to go out and get that thing waived or get rid of it. Otherwise, you know, we're just going to go down the road and go do something else. So it's very possible that it significantly inhibits the ability to even get a third-party offer. So that's example one. Example two, The ROFR holder has no incentive to buy you, right? So if they've got you locked up such that they can always match an offer and buy your company, they've essentially got a free option to buy your client and never have any incentive to buy the company. The one I'm navigating right now, this is exactly what happened. So we my client was luckily, interestingly, able to get an offer from another buyer. And we disclosed to the other buyer before we got an LOI that we had this ROFR. And surprisingly, they were still willing to play ball. And we talked about it. We talked about how to navigate it. We've started going through that process. And at some point, we were all surprised by the fact that the partner actually exercised their ROFR in a very quick period of time, which is very unusual for a company of this size to be able to move as quickly as they did, but they did, and so we had to deal with it. In various negotiations and conversations my client had with their partner, you know, there were statements like, you know, guys, we've talked to you two or three times before about acquiring us, and you didn't do anything, right? And here we go, we got a client, and you know all kinds of things about us. Here we have a company over here that's willing to buy us without knowing anything about us, and they're willing to move, and half the time you're willing to move. What's the deal? And of course, the ROFR holder's response was, well, we have this ROFR, so we had no reason to buy you. So it's the exact thing that I was saying. It's like, this is a reason why you never give this to someone, because they have enormous power over the fate of your company, number one. Number two, to the extent that you intend to seek institutional capital, you will not be able to raise money. Your client will not be able to raise money if they have one of these things in place. It creates a really sticky situation.